Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're diving into a topic that's, well, let's be honest, absolutely essential for life, heart arrhythmias, and those tricky conduction problems.
You've given us quite a bit to unpack.
Yeah, and the goal is to really break it all down so our listeners can understand what's happening when their heart rhythm goes a little offbeat, so to speak.
A personalized roadmap for understanding these crucial aspects of heart health.
Perfect. So let's start with the basics. When we talk about arrhythmias, what are we actually talking about?
Arrhythmias, essentially, are disruptions to the heart's electrical signals. These signals are the instructions for your heart, telling it how fast and how regularly to beat. When there's an issue with the formation of these signals or how they travel or both, it can really throw a wrench in the works. It can mess with your heart rate, the rhythm, or even both.
Right, and that's a big deal because it directly impacts how well your heart can pump blood to the rest of your body. Not a minor inconvenience, for sure.
Absolutely. And it's fascinating how many different types of these rhythm problems there are. Your materials mention both atrial and ventricular arrhythmias. That's a good place to start.
Atrial being the upper chambers of the heart.
Precisely. And ventricular, the lower chambers. So on the atrial side, you've got things like premature atrial complexes, atrial flutter, and the one everyone's probably heard of, atrial fibrillation, AFib.
Okay, and then ventricular arrhythmias.
On the ventricular side, we've got premature ventricular complexes, ventricular tachycardia, the very serious ventricular fibrillation, and perhaps the most concerning of all, ventricular systole.
You mentioned being particularly interested in the differences between atrial and ventricular arrhythmias, so we'll definitely keep that in mind as we break things down.
Excellent point. Now, before we jump into all those specific types, I think it's really helpful to understand how the heart's electrical system is supposed to work, you know, when things are running smoothly.
The basics, the foundation.
Exactly. Think of it like a carefully choreographed electrical dance. The signal usually originates in the SA node, often called the heart's natural pacemaker.
So like the conductor of an orchestra.
That's a perfect analogy. The SA node sets the rhythm and ensures all parts of the heartbeat in harmony. From there, the electrical signal travels to the AV node, then down through what we call the bundle of His.
The bundle of His.
It's a pathway in the heart. It splits into the right and left bundle branches and eventually spreads throughout the ventricles via the Purkinje fibers.
So the ventricles are the final destination for that signal.
Exactly. And if we zoom out a bit, it's this precise electrical pathway that ultimately makes your heart pump, that physical squeezing action.
It's all connected.
Depolarization, that's the on switch, making the heart muscle contract. That systole, when the heart pushes blood out to the body. Then comes repolarization, the off switch, allowing the heart to relax and refill with blood, diastole.
But with arrhythmias, these switches can get out of sync, causing problems with that smooth pumping action.
Precisely. Now, how do we actually see all of this electrical activity? That's where the electrocardiogram, the ECG, comes in.
Like a window into the heart's electrical system.
Exactly. As your sources describe, the ECG is basically a recording of the electrical waveforms the heart generates. And analyzing those waveforms, that's the key to diagnosing and understanding all these different rhythm problems.
Makes sense. So let's talk a little about the ECG itself. Your materials break down those waveforms.
Right. The P wave, that tells us about electrical activity in the atria, the upper chambers. Then we have the QRS complex showing the ventricles, the lower chambers doing their thing. And finally, the T wave. That represents the ventricles recovering, electrically speaking.
So those three, the P, QRS, and T.
They give you the basic snapshot of what's happening electrically in the heart with each beat. There are other more detailed components, but those three are the main players.
Okay, now this is where it gets interesting. You've got these waveforms.
Yeah.
And doctors are trying to figure out what's going on.
Right. They're looking at a continuous recording called an ECG rhythm strip. To spot problems, you need to know what normal looks like. And that's
normal sinus rhythm.
You got it. The gold standard. Regular heart rate, usually between 60 and 100 beats per minute in adults, with a nice P wave before every QRS complex, showing the signal is originating properly in the SA node.
Got it.
Oh, and there are also variations that still originate in the sinus node.
So normal-ish.
Sort of. We call them sinus node arrhythmias. Now, another thing to remember is how the ECG is actually displayed. It's printed on graph paper with these little boxes.
Okay.
And while the exact heart rate calculation uses the paper speed and all that, there's a simple visual guide. Generally, if you see 3 to 5 of those boxes between heartbeats, they usually suggest a normal heart rate. It's a quick and handy reference.
Handy indeed.
Oh, and you know, while we're talking about getting a clear picture of the heart's activity, you brought up something really practical, the 12-lead ECG on a patient with chest hair.
The hairy situation.
Exactly. The thing to remember is that those electrodes need good skin contact to pick up the signal accurately.
So what's the solution?
Clipping the hair, with the patient's permission, of course. Alcohol wipes, while they seem like a good idea, actually aren't recommended. They can mess with the signal. Good old-fashioned clipping is the way to go.
Makes you wonder, why don't they make hairy chest electrodes?
There's a million-dollar idea for you. Okay, back to the arrhythmias themselves. Let's start with normal sinus rhythm, the baseline we talked about.
A steady beat.
Exactly. Regular rate, 60 to 100 beats per minute, P wave before every QRS, all signs pointing to a happy, healthy electrical system.
So that's the ideal. Now, what about when things go slow? A sinus bradycardia, right?
Right. Bradycardia simply means slow heart rate.
Hmm.
In this case, the SA node is still in charge, but it's firing off signals slower than usual, usually below 60 beats per minute.
So what causes that? I mean, aside from just being super relaxed.
Well, you're actually roots at the relaxation part. Your sources mention lower metabolic needs. You know, highly trained athletes, their resting heart rates are often naturally slower.
Interesting. So it's not always a bad thing.
Not necessarily. It could also be due to increased activity of the vagus nerve, which has a calming effect on the heart.
Okay, so those are like the natural reasons.
Yeah.
But what about other causes?
Well, certain medications can slow the heart rate too. And then there are conditions that directly affect the sinus node itself, like sinus node dysfunction. And of course, blockages in the heart's arteries, increased pressure in the skull, and even low oxygen levels in the blood can all contribute to bradycardia.
It sounds like a lot to consider.
Mm-hmm.
So when is bradycardia a cause for concern?
That's a good point. While a slow heart rate isn't always bad, particularly in athletes or those with naturally low resting heart rates, we start to worry when it causes symptoms. Things like dizziness, fatigue, fainting, those are red flags. Also, if the patient is unstable for any reason, that's a sign that medical attention is needed.
And how do doctors treat it?
The approach really focuses on figuring out the root cause and addressing that if possible. Sometimes it's as simple as adjusting medications or managing other health conditions. But in more urgent cases, we might use medications like atropine to speed up the heart. In some cases, a pacemaker might be necessary if the slow rate is severe and causing problems.
So you mentioned pacemakers. We'll get to those a bit later. Now let's shift gears to the other end of the spectrum. Sinus tachycardia.
Right. Tachycardia, that means a fast heart rate. In sinus tachycardia, the SA node is sending out signals faster than normal, typically above 100 beats per minute.
Makes sense. So what makes our heart race?
A lot of it comes down to the body's response to stress. This can be physical stress, like exercise or illness, or emotional stress, like anxiety or excitement.
I know. I've definitely felt my heart pounding during a presentation.
Exactly. It's a normal response. Certain medications can also speed up the heart rate, like some decongestants, for example. And sometimes it can be due to an overactive SA node or issues with the autonomic nervous system, which controls things like heart rate and breathing without us even thinking about it.
So how do you treat tachycardia?
Again, it depends on the cause and whether it's causing symptoms. We'd always try to address the underlying reason first. Simple lifestyle changes, like cutting back on caffeine or finding ways to manage stress, can often make a big difference. Relaxation techniques, deep breathing exercises, those can be very helpful.
I've heard of something called vagal maneuvers, too.
Ah, yes, this can be quite effective. They involve simple actions that stimulate the vagus nerve, which helps to slow down the heart rate. One example is the Valsalva maneuver, where you bear down like you're trying to have a bowel movement. It sounds strange, but it can work. Another is carotid sinus massage, but that should only be done by a doctor. It involves gently massaging the carotid artery in the neck.
Okay, so lifestyle changes, vagal maneuvers, anything else?
In some cases, we might use medications like adenosine or beta blockers to control the heart rate. Rarely, for specific types of tachycardia, procedures like cardioversion or catheter ablation might be considered.
Got it. Now, there's another type of sinus rhythm we should mention, sinus arrhythmia.
Right. In sinus arrhythmia, the SA node is still in charge, but the rhythm isn't perfectly regular. It fluctuates a bit, often speeding up slightly when you inhale and slowing down when you exhale.
So it's kind of like the heart is dancing to the rhythm of your breath.
That's a good way to put it. And the good news is that sinus arrhythmia is usually harmless and rarely needs treatment. It's just something to be aware of.
Okay, that's reassuring. Now let's move on to those atrial arrhythmias we talked about earlier. You mentioned premature atrial complexes, or PACEs.
Right, PACEs. These are basically extra heartbeats that originate in the atria, firing off before the regular beat from the SA node is due.
So like a little hiccup in the rhythm.
Exactly. Most people describe it as a skipped beat or a flutter in their chest.
Okay.
It can be startling, but it's often completely benign.
What causes those extra beats?
Well, everyday things like stress, caffeine, alcohol, those can all be triggers. And then certain medical conditions can play a role too, like an overactive thyroid, high blood pressure, or even heart disease.
Is there anything you can do about them?
For most people, PACEs don't require any treatment at all. If they're frequent or causing bothersome symptoms, we might look for underlying causes and address those. But often, reassurance and lifestyle modifications are enough.
Good to know. Now let's talk about a more serious atrial arrhythmia, atrial fibrillation, or AFib.
Right, AFib. This one is more concerning because it significantly increases the risk of stroke.
Because of those blood clots you mentioned.
Exactly. In AFib, the electrical activity in the atria becomes completely chaotic. Instead of a coordinated contraction, the atria just quiver rapidly and erratically.
So the blood isn't flowing properly.
Exactly. It's like a pool of stagnant water. And when blood sits still, it's more likely to clot. If a clot breaks loose and travels to the brain, it can block a blood vessel and cause a stroke. That's the main danger with AFib.
So how do doctors diagnose it?
The ECG is crucial. In AFib, the rhythm is irregular. It's all over the place. You won't see those nice, distinct P waves because the atria aren't contracting in a coordinated way. Instead, you'll see what we call fibrillatory waves, these small, rapid, irregular bumps on the baseline.
Okay, so the ECG is essential. What other tests might be done?
We might do a transesophageal echocardiogram, or TE, which is an ultrasound of the heart done through the esophagus. It gives us a clearer view of the atria and helps us look for blood clots.
Makes sense.
We also might do blood tests to check thyroid function, kidney function, and liver function. Those can sometimes give us clues about underlying causes or contributing factors.
So it's really a multi-pronged approach to diagnosis.
Absolutely. We want to get a complete picture. And sometimes we might use a Holter monitor, which is like a wearable ECG that records the heart's activity continuously for 24 hours or even longer. It helps us capture those intermittent episodes of AFib that might not show up on a standard ECG.
So once AFib is diagnosed, what are the treatment options?
The main goals are to control the heart rate, prevent those dangerous blood clots, and sometimes try to restore normal rhythm.
So multiple strategies.
Exactly. Medications are a big part of it. Beta blockers and calcium channel blockers are often used to slow down the heart rate.
Okay, and what about preventing clots?
That's crucial. We use anticoagulants, which are blood thinners, to reduce the risk of clot formation. The choice of anticoagulant depends on the individual patient, their risk factors, and other medical conditions.
You mentioned trying to restore normal rhythm. How is that done?
There are a few options. Sometimes medications can be used, and there's a procedure called electrical cardioversion, where a controlled electrical shock is delivered to the chest to try to reset the heart into a normal rhythm.
So it's like rebooting the heart's electrical system.
In a way, yes. And in some cases, a procedure called catheter ablation might be considered. This involves threading catheters through blood vessels to the heart and using energy to destroy the small areas of heart tissue that are causing the abnormal electrical signals.
Interesting. It sounds quite complex.
It is, and it's usually reserved for cases where medications haven't been effective or aren't well tolerated.
Got it. Now, we've talked about PACEs and AFib, but you also mentioned atrial flutter. What's that?
Atrial flutter, it's another atrial arrhythmia. It involves a re-entry circuit in the atrium, causing the heart to beat very fast, but in a regular pattern. Think of it as the electrical signal getting trapped in a loop, continuously stimulating the atria.
Okay, so fast and regular. How is that different from AFib?
AFib is fast and irregular. Atrial flutter is fast but organized. On an ECG, you'll see what we call sawtooth waves instead of those fibrillatory waves we see in AFib.
So what causes atrial flutter and how is it treated?
The causes are similar to those of other atrial arrhythmias, things like high blood pressure, heart disease, thyroid problems, lung disease, and even excessive alcohol consumption.
Okay, and the treatment?
Similar to AFib, treatment focuses on controlling the heart rate and preventing clots. We might use medications like beta blockers or calcium channel blockers to slow things down, and anticoagulants are often prescribed to reduce the stroke risk.
So the approaches are similar.
Yes, there are definitely some overlaps, but it's important to remember that each arrhythmia is unique and treatment decisions are always individualized based on the patient's specific situation.
That makes sense. Now let's talk about what happens when someone comes to the hospital with an arrhythmia. How do doctors and nurses assess what's going on?
Well, the first thing is to understand what type of arrhythmia it is, right? Is it atrial or ventricular? What's the rate? Is it regular or irregular? Those are the initial questions.
So looking at the heart rhythm is key.
Absolutely. But it's not just about the rhythm. We also need to consider the patient's overall condition. Are they stable? Are they having any symptoms like chest pain, shortness of breath, dizziness?
So taking the whole picture into account.
Exactly. We'll also want to know about any past medical history, current medications, and any potential triggers for the arrhythmia.
Triggers like stress or caffeine.
Right. And then the physical exam can give us even more clues. We'll check their blood pressure, listen to their heart and lungs, feel their pulse, and look for any signs of fluid buildup.
So it's a thorough evaluation.
It has to be. Arrhythmias can sometimes lead to serious complications, so we need to be very thorough in our assessment.
Speaking of complications, what are the potential risks associated with arrhythmias?
Well, as we've discussed, one of the biggest concerns with some arrhythmias, especially atrial fibrillation, is the risk of stroke. The irregular heartbeat can cause blood to pool in the atria, increasing the risk of clots forming, which can then travel to the brain and cause a stroke.
Right. That's why anticoagulants are so important.
Exactly. Another concern is heart failure. If the heart isn't pumping effectively because of an arrhythmia, it can lead to a buildup of fluid in the lungs and other parts of the body. This can cause shortness of breath, fatigue, and swelling in the legs and ankles.
So the heart's pumping ability is crucial.
It is. And in some cases, certain arrhythmias can be life-threatening, especially those that affect the ventricles, the lower chambers of the heart. Ventricular fibrillation, for example, is a very serious arrhythmia where the electrical activity in the ventricles becomes completely chaotic, causing the heart to quiver instead of pumping effectively. This can lead to cardiac arrest if not treated immediately.
So early detection and treatment are essential. Now let's talk about what healthcare professionals do to help manage arrhythmias.
Well, the first step is to identify and treat any underlying causes. If the arrhythmia is due to a medical condition like high blood pressure or thyroid disease, managing those conditions can often help control the arrhythmia.
Okay, so treating the root cause. What else?
Lifestyle modifications can also play a role. Things like reducing stress, limiting caffeine and alcohol, getting regular exercise, and maintaining a healthy weight can all help improve heart health and reduce the risk of arrhythmias.
So healthy habits are important for heart rhythm too.
Absolutely. And then there are medications. There are many different types of medications used to treat arrhythmias, and the choice of medication depends on the specific type of arrhythmia and the individual patient's needs.
Can you give us some examples?
Sure. Beta blockers, which we mentioned earlier, can help slow down the heart rate and reduce blood pressure. Calcium channel blockers can also slow down the heart rate and improve blood flow to the heart. Sodium channel blockers can help regulate the heart's electrical activity. And potassium channel blockers can help lengthen the heart's electrical recovery time, which can prevent certain types of arrhythmias.
So a variety of medications are available.
Yes, and there are others too. The key is to find the right medication or combination of medications that effectively controls the arrhythmia without causing unwanted side effects.
That makes sense. Now, what about those other treatments we mentioned earlier, like pacemakers, cardioversion, and defibrillation? When are those used?
Those are usually considered when medications alone aren't enough to control the arrhythmia or when the arrhythmia is causing serious symptoms or complications.
Okay, so let's start with pacemakers. What exactly do they do?
Pacemakers are small, implantable devices that help regulate the heart's rhythm. They work by sending electrical impulses to the heart muscle, stimulating it to beat at a certain rate.
So they're like an artificial pacemaker for the heart.
Exactly. They're often used to treat bradycardia, where the heart beats too slowly. But they can also be used for other types of arrhythmias, like heart block, where the electrical signals don't travel properly from the atria to the ventricles.
So how are pacemakers implanted?
It's a relatively minor procedure. The pacemaker is usually implanted under the skin just below the collarbone, and thin wires called leads are threaded through veins to the heart. The procedure is typically done under local anesthesia, and patients can often go home the same day or the next day.
Are there different types of pacemakers?
There are. Some pacemakers only pace the ventricles, while others pace both the atria and the ventricles. Some pacemakers are fixed rate, meaning they deliver impulses at a constant rate, while others are demand pacemakers, meaning they only deliver impulses when the heart rate drops below a certain threshold.
So they're tailored to the individual's needs.
Exactly. The choice of pacemaker depends on the specific type of arrhythmia and the individual's heart's needs.
What about complications? Are there any risks associated with pacemakers?
Like any medical procedure, there are potential risks. The most common complications are infection, bleeding, and pneumothorax, which is a collapsed lung. But these complications are rare, and most people who get pacemakers do very well with them.
That's good to know. Now let's talk about cardioversion. When is that procedure used?
Cardioversion is used to treat arrhythmias where the heart is beating too fast, such as atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter. It involves delivering a controlled electrical shock to the chest, which essentially resets the heart's rhythm.
So it's like rebooting the system, like you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. The shock is synchronized with the heart's electrical activity to avoid delivering it during a vulnerable period in the heart's cycle.
Okay, that sounds important.
It is. The procedure is usually done under sedation, and patients typically recover quickly. In many cases, cardioversion can successfully restore normal rhythm.
And what about defibrillation? How is that different from cardioversion?
Defibrillation is similar to cardioversion, but it's used in more emergency situations, like ventricular fibrillation, where the heart is quivering chaotically and not pumping blood effectively.
So a life-saving procedure.
Absolutely. Unlike cardioversion, defibrillation delivers a high-energy shock that's not synchronized with the heart's electrical activity. The goal is to completely stop the heart's electrical activity, allowing it to hopefully restart in a normal rhythm.
I've seen those defibrillator paddles on TV shows.
Yes, those are external defibrillators, and they're often used in emergency settings. But there are also implantable defibrillators called ICDs, which are similar to pacemakers, but can deliver both pacing and shocks.
So they're like a combination device.
Exactly. ICDs are often used in people who are at high risk for life-threatening arrhythmias.
That's amazing technology. Mm-hmm. So let's say someone has a permanent device implanted, like a pacemaker or an ICD. What kind of follow-up care is needed?
Regular checkups are essential. We'll want to make sure the device is working properly and that the patient is doing well. We'll also monitor for any potential complications like infection or lead dislodgement.
How often do those checkups typically happen?
It depends, but usually every few months or so, at least initially. Over time, the checkups may become less frequent.
And what about battery life? Do these devices need to be replaced eventually?
They do. The battery life of pacemakers and ICDs varies depending on the device and how much it's used, but they typically last for several years. When the battery starts to get low, the device will signal that it needs to be replaced, and a relatively minor procedure is done to swap out the old device for a new one.
Wow, that's fascinating technology. We've covered a lot of ground today. Any final thoughts for our listeners?
I think the main takeaway is that arrhythmias are common, and they can range from harmless to life-threatening. It's important to be aware of the signs and symptoms of arrhythmias and to seek medical attention if you experience anything unusual. With early detection and proper management, most people with arrhythmias can live long and healthy lives.
Excellent advice. And if anyone wants to delve deeper into this topic, where would you recommend they go?
The American Heart Association is a great resource for reliable information on heart health, including arrhythmias. They have a website, pamphlets, and even a helpline. And of course, don't hesitate to talk to your doctor if you have any questions or concerns. They're your best resource for personalized advice.
That's great. Thank you for this insightful deep dive into the world of arrhythmias. It's been truly enlightening.
My pleasure. It's always a privilege to talk about heart health.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll be back next week with another fascinating topic. Until then, stay curious and keep those hearts beating strong.
And regular.
Regular, of course.
Yeah.
But maybe with a little bit of healthy sinus arrhythmia thrown in for good measure.
Agreed. It's all part of the symphony of life.